So we're here with Jonna Curti, a longtime friend of the show, the co-author of States of Incarceration with Jared Shanahan, and the co-editor of Treason to Whiteness is Loyalty to Humanity, the Noel Ignatieff reader, and a current Chicago resident by way of the Bronx,
yes,
who was in Chicago this week for the big protests, but unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, she couldn't attend. What happened this week, Jonna?
Well, I was flying back from my brother's wedding. First of all, hello, everybody. So nice to be back on the show.
Yeah, hi. Always a pleasure to have you. I have to say right at the outset that we've done 16 hours of overtime already this week, and I got another 10 to 12 ahead of me tomorrow. We're finishing out this job. So if I'm crispy and toasty and roasted and kind of washed today, that's why. But we won't let it affect the recording.
Just another reason to abolish the wage labor system so
that's
Sean
right.
can be less toasted.
Less toasted and yeah, not have to work all this OT. But welcome. Tell us. So what's Chicago been like? Probably pretty horrible.
Yeah, it's been pretty crazy. So I arrived Monday, which was the first day of the DNC insane, display. And it's been kind of crazy. Chicago's been traffic jams everywhere. Where the event was held is at the Bulls Stadium, which is on the city's west side. But it also makes the protest a little bit difficult because it's a bit out of the way. It's a very different venue from the 68 convention, which was held in Grand Park and Millennium Park right downtown. So, it was quite a spectacle from the beginning, as expected. Just like 4 days and finally they left. So Brandon Johnson has been declaring it a success. And I hope we could get into some of that.
Well, at least you got your damn city back. You know, all these delegates flying in from around the country to do spectacle and wreak havoc upon your daily lives. It's like dark-sided Olympics, and the Olympics is already dark.
All these live streamers, too. You know, I got the experience of choosing which live stream to watch. I alternated between Hassan, who was at the protest, but also mostly at the convention. And then a streamer I found called Anarchist Kitty, who was at the protests entirely. So I was like, do I watch people like banging on the fence with Palestine flags, yelling at the cops, or do I watch Hassan talking to Ro Khanna? And I alternated between the two, but
everyone who knows me knows
what I chose to watch more.
So it was Anarchist Titty, like T-I-D-D-I-E?
No, Kitty, like a small cat.
So it was like a child. Oh, a kitty cat.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
a cat.
Guess you're not the gutter, Sean.
I don't know. I don't follow streams. I don't know what's on there.
You're like, it's a like, frat summer. It's kitty.
I know they love that like hot tub stream shit. So I didn't know if it was like a crossover thing. Like bring your hot tub to the protest. And
the most surprising of all was Chris Cuomo. Did you catch his reaction to the DNC? He gave this little, what I thought was a very camaraderie speech about who the real, pulling the real strings.
Let me reveal a reality to you that has to be spoken to here, okay? These are the soldiers. These are the men and the women that go back to their constituencies and their communities, and they fight. They take time from their jobs. They take time from their families. Republicans and Democrats alike, that's what they do. They need to charge these people up. They need to be able to get them on board. But there is another reality that is literally looking down on them. Greg, look at the ring of sweets, okay? This is not unique to Democrats. There is a game of money. When people talk about uniparty, we are strangled by the money reality in our politics. Those suites start at 500 grand. You think there's like a teacher group up in there? You think it's like the Cub Scouts of Columbia County, South Carolina, that's up in those boxes? Some of them are lobbies and good things. The media boxes, you think they're free? Why do you think I'm on the floor? News Nation is not a broke company. Nextstar is a massive organization. We are corporate media. We don't have one of those boxes because that's the game. You pay to play. Those boxes are filled with the same people that they say they're going to regulate.
I know what he's going to say, and it's the Italians. You know, Chris Cuomo knows that the Italians run everything. You look at the major CEOs of the corporations and the banks, Italians all the way down. I got to say from the outset, and I hope this makes for really good content, I have not watched a single Twitch stream. I have not barely read any news reports. I very briefly watched a little bit of like Barack Obama's clips, but this is all going to be new to me. And so I'm really looking forward to this report back on this event that was watched by like 50 million people.
But Sean, you're so fired up about Sean O'Brien at the RNC, and, you know, and Sean Fain gives what many called the best speech at the DNC, and you sleep.
Was it a barn raiser? Was it like a really good speech? I should have watched it. I feel like an asshole now.
Ah, I mean, leftists were excited about it, but I didn't particularly find it all that great.
He wore that that scab shirt, right? Trump's a scab.
Right. He like did the big reveal like it was like a wrestling match. Like he took it. I did see clips of him doing that. That's
about
all.
He didn't rip it off like Hulk Hogan, unfortunately. He just took it off.
Oh, bummer. Once more, the Republicans have better, like, sicker, more stupid optics.
Yeah, true. But we mentioned Brat Summer before, and I noticed that the first day of protest, there was a Brat flag. You've heard of Black Flag, but there was a Brat green and black anarchy flag that some black blocker was waving. And then, I don't know if this was a edit.
Shauna, was that you? Was that you,
Shauna? You got me, guys. Why you gotta ask me like that?
Sorry, dude. I'm so sorry.
I don't know if this was an edit, but I saw a picture of it being burned later on. Like, maybe they just...
I think that's real.
Yeah. I mean, it was... I think maybe we could talk a little bit about the protest. You know, I think, so first, you know, while the DNC is running on good vibes and joy and I don't know, every...
Joy through strength, yeah. Strength through joy.
You know, all what's happening outside is, you know, folks are gathering to protest and march. There's various marches that have been called. Unfortunately, what ended up happening is that there was a lot of policing of protesters, you know, a lot of kind of, you know, making sure people are not, you know, doing anything that's like antagonizing or breaking away. And I think when then there were attempts to do that by some groups, you know, they were kind of quickly brought in line or the cops were brought in. So it was really terrible, honestly. And I think just watching, you know, the state of the protest movement outside the DNC and just watching the complete bubble that was the DNC inside of the convention is just really, really disappointing and quite depressing, to be honest. And, you know, I don't want to bring down the vibes of the show, but I mean, I think it speaks a lot to where we are right now, where, you know, like, you know, quote unquote, left movements have been really pushed to the side, right, by, you know, the ascendancy of Kamala. I don't know.
I think it's good to bring the vibe down a little bit. I think we should be realistic about this. And I think, you know, when I say, oh, I haven't been paying attention or whatever, it's because I've managed in my old age to free myself, you know, to free myself from the sense that like there's a like potential within this particular amalgamation of class forces that is the Democratic Party, or that like anything we can do can like positively affect that entire thing, or and also too that like it's the only option because, you know, I got the ILC now, we got the ILC, and I think if we like just go fully, like Varn would say, fully in and through the black pill, we can come out the other side and actually like feel good that ultimately like this is a party formation. This is a disgusting class formation that has to be taken down. We have nothing in common with them. Ultimately, we need to supersede and destroy them. And we can watch their silly games in Chicago, or we cannot. And realize that ultimately it's the class and class institutions and class power that matter. And Democrats have nothing to do with that at all. They can't betray you, you know, because you're not them and we're not them. So Just gotta let it go, man.
Yeah, you know, I almost entirely agree with you, but I want to be a little bit varnished here and say it is. I think it's a little bit interesting to watch the relationship between the left and the DNC, or at least like the deflated hopes of because people were like excited about walls. You know, they thought that maybe they could push Harris on the Palestine issue, and obviously, what we saw at the DNC was quite the opposite of that. Like, really, she just repeated the Biden policy on Palestine, which is also the Trump policy on Palestine, the stated policy, at least. I want to read a tweet from someone named Grace Cathedral Park on Twitter. They say, the switch to Kamala just worked. Like, fact is, a lot of people who, rightly nobly, were discontented with the administration and bucked at its plainly monstrous policy in Palestine have now been distracted and brought back into the fold by a Democratic Party by Carter II. And that's in response to another tweet that just is talking about how disappointed they were at the protests, a tweet by Peak Capitalism, where they said everything was dominated by police and every subway car downtown had 8 cops. Was that your experience, Jana?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think there was something about, it speaks to that, like the kind of the energy has been sapped by, like, you know, the Kamala ascendancy. I think even the first night, the fact that AOC, is the first speaker and gets cheers by the entire convention when she praises Harris for working tirelessly to get a ceasefire in Gaza,
get
the hostages home. Meanwhile, 30 uncommitted delegates are outside. Meanwhile, her own squad members, which I'm like, how are y'all even friends at this point? Like, Ilhan, right? She's like doing this, whatever, right? She's like trying to at least lead the like uncommitted delegates, outside to do a sit-in, to do a protest against the DNC. But I do think I saw this also among a lot of kind of like rad liberals or folks who had been really much politicized by everything that has happened in Gaza, by Israel, by the Zionist project. All of a sudden, Kamala, Tim Walz come in and it's like, oh, got to drop everything. We got to make sure to defeat Trump. And all of a sudden we hear less about Gaza, less about Palestine. Mm-hmm. U.S. imperialism, and we hear Project 2025, right? And I think that boogeyman of Trump being a fascist, the apocalyptic future of no elections and no democracy becomes another way to kind of steal all of that energy, right? But I do want to say though, this is a very friendly critique, but I would like to say that I think there's also divisions within the pro-Palestine movement itself, right? That is also perhaps a part of this, right? You have for sure those who are seeking more towards pushing pressure on Harris through electoral, whether it's like trying to meet with her, trying to push the uncommitted delegates in Michigan. Right. You have those that are taking the streets, not so much of a focus on direct action. Right. As we've seen, for instance, in the UK or other parts of the world. So I think with even the pro-Palestine movement seems a little bit divided on the strategy of how to force the ceasefire, how to force the U.S., towards an arms embargo with Israel.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I mean, if you're trying to force a change in U.S. foreign policy, there's really no way to do that besides influencing the people in charge.
Yeah, work from the inside, get inside the party, the uncommitted thing. Obviously, people use a lot of political capital on that to try to shift the winds. But then, as I understand it, people were disappointed in Kamala Harris's speech regarding Gaza, right?
Yeah, I mean, what she did on that last day, first of all, it was so surreal. Like, I remember one moment I turned on the TV and I was like, what is going on in here? Like, there was a sheriff explaining 2020 to us. There was chants of like USA. There's Kamala like giving this fiery speech about how she's always going to stand for Israel and stand with Israel, and kind of calling for a lethal military
Yeah.
Like power and tightening borders. And it just felt like, what a different moment. I know we are celebrating like representation in many ways, right? But it's like, what a moment, what a different moment from 2020, mm-hmm. right? Is like, it was like a cop on stage, chant of USA, and like, you know, Kamala saying that, you know, she promises us that she's going to be the toughest, you know, chief, like, of command of our military power.
And on the borders, too. She's tacked to the right of Trump on immigration.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, there's like a way to be blackpilled about this. Like, millions of people used political capital pressure tactics. There were thousands of people demonstrating outside and it didn't do anything. And it's just as bad as under Biden. And that's all very true. You could see it as blackpilling. You could like be completely disconsolate about it, or you could see it as a clarifying moment. And I hope that it comes as a clarifying moment because, you know, my first election I voted in was the year 2000. And I've seen people constantly throw themselves up against this wall, bash their heads against this wall over and over and over again every 2 to 4 years. And I really, really, really hope that people can see this for what it is, that this convention and this even the sea change from 2020 to 2024 has clarified things for people, and they realize they can't work with this anymore. They can't pretend that there's a way to like possibly influence this.
There was a tweet I really liked. I was like on Twitter a lot as I was watching the clown show. Some of it was entertaining, and I want to get back to some of the entertaining aspects of some of what the folks said. But one of the tweets I read, I have it here, it says, "A perfect encapsulation of the Democratic Party. You're led to believe you're getting Beyonce, but instead you get a cop, a Republican, a CIA director, and a boast about the U.S. military's lethality." Mm-hmm. And I thought that was pretty funny. And kind of true, you know? Although there were some funny moments, I would say the second day, when would the Obama's talk, was it the second day?
I think so. I believe.
Obama kind of inadvertently made like a penis joke.
Yeah, wasn't it? It's about dick size.
Yeah, that was pretty funny, I thought. And I thought the last day, D.L. Hughley was pretty funny about joking on Trump, which he does regularly on his radio show. But he said Donald Trump will finally know what it's like when you get left for a younger woman.
Oh, shit. Got his ass, dude.
Kenan Thompson was pretty funny, too. I always love seeing Kenan Thompson. Even in Max Blumenthal, Gray Zone was like cornering everybody in the hallways. And Kenan Thompson didn't give a great answer about Gaza, but he gave the best answer, which is just like, yeah, I know what's going on there. It's horrible. It needs to stop. But like, I'm just some guy. I can't do anything about it, you know. Everyone else has just ignored him.
Yeah.
What do we make of the two great dreams of, I'd say, the left and like the center left, which is a repeat either of 1968, which of course was a Chicago convention where rioters outside protesting against the Vietnam War caused absolute havoc, made national television, really showed the strict division between like liberals and the left at that point, not just with regards to Vietnam, but many, many other things. Or the other thing that people were interested in was to see a repeat of 1924, which of course was like an open convention where it took like days and days and days in this very chaotic, like, quote unquote, democratic process to try to figure out who the nominee would be. We didn't get either of those things.
Was 24 Al Smith? Who were the
Al Smith? Al Smith versus like some like racist dude, like real racist.
It was a wet versus dry kind of thing.
Wet versus dry sort of thing. Yeah, Dixiecrats versus like the Northern Urban Machine.
And those dry bastards won.
Yeah, they got him. But we didn't get either of those things. In fact, what we seemed to get was like a very, at least on the face of it, unified Democratic Party that was a combination of using security outside and stage managing within, managed to like pull this thing off without there being a 68, and managed by everybody getting behind Harris as everybody got behind Biden 4 years ago to have like what appeared to be a very unified convention. What do we make of
it? I'll try to answer that. So, I mean, my reading of 68, I don't know much about 24. Most people who remember it as a massive defeat for the left. I mean, there was, you know, it influenced the DNC. There's like tear gas wafting into delegates and politicians' hotel rooms. And someone gave a speech denouncing police brutality on the floor of the DNC. We didn't see much of that. We didn't see any of that at this DNC. But the protests themselves were sort of advertised as like a mass mobilization, a day of rage. There would be riots. And I saw the movie Medium Cool last week. We actually showed it at Woodbine. It's been showing at a lot of places just because it's about a Chicago DNC in 68. And what people don't really talk about so much from that movie is it shows it's a very kind of black-pilled movie because it's made by Haskell Wexler, who was a sympathizer of the left for sure. He had his footage of the protests make it look pretty much like a bad protest today, where it's unorganized, people are sort of confused, and like some people are there to riot, people build barricades, but they're not good barricades, and people just get kind of clobbered over and over again. And you get the sense from that movie of the demobilization after 67, which you saw massive riots that repeated in 68 after the assassination of King. The actual political mobilization of 68 felt like most of the left a major defeat. And of course, that was sealed with the election of Nixon afterwards. And, you know, this might be a similar moment, although I think what is more likely to happen is it'll all be forgotten when school gets back into session, and we're going to see encampments and occupations again. And that, combined with whatever October surprise Netanyahu has in store to get Trump elected, which I am just terrified about what that's going to be. I can only assume it'll be a regional war or something more covert than that. I think that's going to just overshadow any thought of like that the protest was a failure or a success. Like, I think we won't even be thinking about the DNC at that point.
Interesting.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with Andy. I think that was a really good breakdown. I just wanted to add that I think, you know, when I think about also like 68 and just the widespread popularity of the anti-Vietnam protest movement, right? Even though it was a defeat in the ways you talk about it, Andy, for the left, is like, I mean, people were drawn to come to Chicago to protest for that, right? That like the war was waging years in. I feel like the Palestinian, the pro-Palestine protest, what's happening in Gaza has really, angered a lot of people, has brought a lot of people out to the streets. But I think the Democrats, for the first time, have been really smart about how they played their cards, right? They took out Biden, you know, before the convention. They gave the left a little bit, some crumbs with the vice president nominee, bringing in AOC the first night. I think there is like a lot of like political strategies. And I think on top of that, there is the constant, again, the boogeyman of Trump.
Right.
I mean, I honestly think, like Sean was saying, like, I didn't even watch the DNC. I think, like, when you talk to most people, like, nobody cares. Nobody, like, there's very few people that really, really care about Kamala, and really, really, like, you know, whatever, want her to be in power. Most people, I would say, are still the never Trumpers, right? Like, they don't want Trump. People are really scared of what another Trump presidency would mean when, you know, because of what he did a lot, you know, to the federal government in some ways, to the Supreme Court. So I don't think people are as excited in that sense. It's still like the fear of Trump, right? And I think in that way, the Democrats have been really good about, you know, shutting down any kind of quote unquote progressive or left critiques, right? I mean, Kamala did a good job at that when, in Michigan, right? Like, how disrespectful to be like, to tell pro-Palestinian protesters, like, essentially, like, shut up or you're gonna get Trump again. So I think the way that, I don't know, I think a lot about American political consciousness in this moment, right? That I think people are able to say, well, you know, maybe if we vote Kamala, we could, I think there's still a hope that that she could be pushed.
Right.
Whereas people don't envision that with Trump, right? So I think a lot of like progressives are, you know, have adopted this mentality of, you know, well, let's first elect Kamala, then we'll deal with like the ceasefire. And we know that's like, that's not going to happen, right? We have a better chance of pushing the Democrats into the ocean than we have them push left, right? Like, that's not really going to happen to some degree. But I think there is like, I think that's kind of the hope. And in many ways, that influenced a lot, I think, why we didn't see the massive protests that we saw. I mean, Chicago has, what, 85,000 Palestinians? Mm. It's like one of the largest diasporas, you know? So I think it also begs the question of, you know, what really happened, right? And I just want to say, it's not only Palestine, we're climate change, like all of these other issues that affect us, right? Immigration, right? Like all of these things. And we didn't see people turn out for any of those issues. So I don't know that we could like just cast the blame one way, right? Like we also have to look at like what is happening to the political consciousness of ordinary Americans. And I would say a lot of folks are just disengaged. They're just like, they don't really see a point in perhaps like protesting Kamala or protesting the DNC, right? And kind of are maybe being like, you know what, like hands off and just like, let's let the clown show run its course. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if you look at Trump's second attempt here, or I guess third attempt, it's his third campaign, he's lost a lot of his Jews too. Like, say what you want about Trump, but like in very like skeevy and insightful ways, he would often like lie very productively, or he'd say things that you're never supposed to say, which is like all politicians are corrupt, but like I'm the only one that'll actually admit that I've got interests. Trump doesn't have that anymore. In fact, Trump's like dour campaign can only remind you of the difference between like Bernie as an insurgent candidate in 2016 versus Bernie as like a more, I wouldn't say establishment, but more established candidate in 2020. I feel like this election doesn't have the same pizzazz. I feel like the Joe Biden stepping down, or at least not putting his hat in the ring this time, has meant that there are stakes to this election for sure, but it's like either way, it's kind of a continuation because so many of Biden's policies were like warmed over and effective Trump policies, especially on tariffs and industrial policy and the pivot to China and arming Ukraine and all this stuff. I feel like maybe this is giving people too much credit, like the quote-unquote average American. I think people realize that the stakes are pretty low, that there's going to be a continuation of what's been going on either which way.
Yeah, I mean, the Kamala, their messaging has been forwards. You know, we're not going back, we're going forwards. And I think the implication of that is we're going to just continue doing what Biden was doing with a more competent figurehead for it. And I don't, I know the Democrats think that people like Biden or they think progressives like Biden, but I agree. The vast majority of people do not. But I want to talk about another issue that I think is sort of not to the fore, but really underlying everything, which is what Jana mentioned earlier, 2020. And we're not, you know, like Black Lives Matter type issues have really dropped away dramatically since then. I feel like people think the uprising kind of resolved it in the sense of like, you know, you can have massive street movements, but nothing gets achieved on a policy level. But it does, it has come up over and over again obliquely, most obviously in the way Trump tries to remind people of how Tim Walz was the governor of Minnesota during 2020. And, you know, their take is that he just let the city burn down, which is... I mean, you know, the rioting was pretty intense. There was a lot of buildings burned, but you know, the Twin Cities still remain.
Still remains. It's still a thing.
But then, from the left too, you get people saying like, "Oh, you guys are going to support Tim Walz? Look, he sent in the National Guard. Remember that?" And then I even saw a right wing rejoinder to that, claiming that him sending the National Guard was about COVID, and they were the curfew was to keep people inside during COVID, and they're shooting like paintballs at anyone who tried to leave. And then even beyond that, there's some very weird race stuff going on this election. I mean, interestingly, at the DNC, you didn't hear a ton about Kamala being potentially the first female president or the second black president. The identity politics were certainly way toned down since 2016. You also certainly didn't hear a lot about kids in cages and that kind of thing. Quite the opposite.
No. Yeah.
Oh, they don't want to bring that up.
No, that's a sore subject.
But yeah. Even on top of that, and this is something that gets into some of Jana's work, writing about race and the work of Noel Ignatieff, Trump is trying to portray Kamala as a Dolezal, as a fake black woman. And then there was her doing this lame joke that Tim Wallis is so white that mayo is too spicy for him. And then there was like a few days of Republicans feigning outrage at that, as if that's anti-white racism. And beyond that, of course, there's, you know, Trump is really emphasizing this narrative that there's urban chaos and high crime rates as a result of Biden being president. So I think the questions of race, although they're not being really explicitly stated, except by Trump claiming that like millions of Salvadorian Hannibal Lecters are cannibalizing young white women all across the country. Yeah. I think the politics of the George Floyd uprising are still being referenced, but it's referenced to sort of play into the fantasies of, you know, the typical voters who are middle class, upper middle class, wealthy, and, you know, specifically trying to win over suburban whites to one side or the other.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there was that insane clip, you know, Trump when he came to Chicago, and there was the Black Journalism Convention happening in town, and they did an interview with him. I don't know if you guys remember, and that's where he was like, well, I wasn't aware that Kamala was black. She's been saying she's, you know, Indian, and you know, he kind of befuddled around her race, like talking about her racially. So I think you're right, but I do think that, you know, when you looked at the DNC in that way, I think they did a really good job, which is important. I mean, we do want to live in a multicultural society, right? Like, of like showcasing people of color, immigrants, women, you know, there was like black parents, all of that, right? But at the same time, I mean, on the last day, you know, you had young Latinos. There was that the young Latino from Texas who's like a content creator who basically started talking about immigration, referencing Reagan, right? It's like, come on now, you know? So I don't know. I think there is like, there's a lot of, you know, I think like really at the heart of like the DNC and the trying to come together as one party is to give lip service, as they always do, to some progressive ideas, but at the heart of it being a very centrist, you know, moderate party, right? And I think when you look at the Democrats on policy, especially around criminal justice, reform is completely out of the 2024 election cycle, like policy, right? So in 2020, it was about past things like ban the chokehold, right? Biden was going to sign this bill that was going to be named after George Floyd. 4 years later, we hear nothing about criminal justice reforms even, right?
Yeah, that's true.
We've done a complete like 180, I would say probably 360 around policing, around incarceration. Like there's really no talk of a lot of reform. The Democrats are calling for tighter borders, right? Biden's policy is pretty strict about who he's let, you know, who is being allowed in, right? I mean, Haitians are continuously being deported. So I think it will be really interesting to see what a black woman president means for Black Lives Matter when we know that police violence continues. And actually somebody on Twitter, a Chicago activist, was kind of tallying the numbers and was saying that, you know, 2024 has actually had higher numbers already than 2023, right? So we could imagine like the kinds of issues that animate, you know, working class black and brown people will continue, right? So what would that look like under a black female president?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people are making, you know, these comparisons to the Obama era, right? And like, okay, under Obama is when we saw Black Lives Matter come into the fore, right? So mm-hmm. I don't know. I just think for sure, Kamala has like, invite, you know, has a lot of folks and followers, being an AKA, a lot of, especially Black college educated women, right, who are supporting her. And it's like, of course, we shouldn't be descending into stupid, vile, like racist caricatures or all those terrible things. But at the same time, I would say that a lot of young people who have been politicized by Gaza and by what's happening in the Sudan and everything are kind of looking and saying like, okay, like, you know, here we are again at representational politics, you know, once again, like, what can we expect? And I don't know, I think a lot of young people are really disengaged from even what a first Black female president would mean.
I want to address the thing you said right at the outset, which is that, like, we all want to live in a pluralistic and multicultural society. And I think that's true for all three of us. I think that's true for, like, most people in America, despite there, of course, being unreconstructed racists out there. The question is like, is this the way? Is this, like, our way? Is this the way to have a multicultural country and a nation? Is it to have, like, various different cartelized, like, ethnic and racial and national interest groups that are coalitioned together in this capitalist party that whose multicultural leaders are, like, middle class themselves or petty bourgeois ideologically in their politics, and that the only way you can have a pluralistic nation is to have all of these different sort of competing interest groups in one large coalition where they fight out what the spoils are going to be and what the representation is going to be, like, alongside members of the bourgeoisie and alongside the military industrial blob. All in service of maintaining a world-spanning empire whose violence only increases by the day. I mean, I think all of us want a pluralistic society. But, like, this is not the way, man. We see this spiraling out of control, and we see the way in which, like, real working-class interests, no matter what your color is, what your gender is, what your nation is, we see those subordinated to a class project and an imperial project that only more and more and more makes, like, domestic and foreign violence increase as this, you know, entire kind of edifice crumbles. So, like, we should affirm this aspect of, like, what the progressive quote unquote party is doing in this country, but point out that it can't actually do the things that it claims. And that, in fact, like, racial divisions and anti-Semitism are getting worse, partially because of the policies that this capitalist party implements day in and day out.
Hey, Jana, there's some background noise. I don't know if it's a fan or something.
These damn Chicago birds. It's the cicadas. What are they called?
You call them Chicago birds?
They must be big Chicago out there. Flies.
Oh, they're, like, everywhere. They're so freaking annoying. Yeah, another thing that I find really interesting is the framing of the election between a felon and a prosecutor. That's so crazy.
Yeah, felon and a prosecutor. That's how they have it. Well, it does fit with, like, the vital centrist worldview, right? That this vital center exists, and that, like, Kamala or Biden or Obama or whoever it is are, like, the ones keeping us from fascism, keeping us from destruction, keeping us from presumably race war, right? All of these things are kind of implicit in this. And the Democratic Party, of course, is, like, integrating the left wing, or, like, the neocon wing of the Republican Party into itself. So these things shouldn't be very surprising. We're in a moment of realignment right now. And it doesn't mean that the RNC is going to become the party of the working class. Neither of these parties are going to be, right? But, like, truly sick and twisted things are happening within the Democratic Party as some of the worst people in the world are brought into this broader tent of, like, middle class interest group coalitions. And it's really fucked up to watch.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I was thinking about, I wanted to get your guys' opinion. You know, what do you think of this? You know, usually we say, and I remember in 2016 believing this, 2008 with Obama, you know, that the left or left movements have a better chance under, like, Democratic Party like leadership or the Democrats being in power. And I've been thinking a lot about that, and I have my own answer to it. But I kind of was wondering what your thoughts on that was, because I bet that there's a lot of folks that are going to vote for Kamala who are not going to maybe share it, right? Who are like, okay, like, I'm just going to vote. Like, I just don't want Trump. And I believe that at least the left will be in a better place to fight for things under, you know, under the Democrats.
I think two things. The first is that by seeing ourselves, and I don't think this, but many people do, as part of this broader coalition that could have influence within it, completely forecloses the possibility of building an independent class politics that might someday build like an autonomous class party that might actually be able to push these interests forward. And also, too, I think that like saying, oh, the left will do better under Democrats, we've seen 1,000 times over and over again that that's not true, that in fact, the left, such as it is more than happy oftentimes to liquidate itself into the Democratic Party, which is what happened when they chose Waltz instead of that Shapiro guy. So, and then if you consider like the resistance to Trump to be a movement of the left, and in some cases it was, that was a massive movement that you saw in this country. And like they pushed a lot of things, and probably like a lot of Black Lives Matter in 2020 wouldn't have happened if it hadn't happened under a Republican president. So I'm not sure where people get this idea, except if they're trying to convince you as sheepdogs to like enter back into the grand bourgeois party coalition.
All right, well, let me try to be a sheepdog for a second, because...
Do it.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely right. There's, you know, there's not going to be an independent labor, an autonomous labor movement under the Democrats or through the Democrats. And I, yes, we saw Black Lives Matter kick off under Obama and Occupy, but we also saw the George Floyd uprising under Trump, and we saw this resistance movement against Trump, which is at some points cringe, at some points pretty powerful. And that mobilization, I think, came from the shock of and the fear of what Trump was saying, what he represented, and that the Republican Party was being taken over by neo-Nazis, at least hegemonically.
It seemed like that with the rise of the alt-right at the same time. Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, who mopped up that situation? Antifa, to a large degree. And then, yeah, and then Biden sort of runs on that as like, I'm the anti-Charlottesville candidate. And then, but you have echoes of that in this election. Getting back to some of the race stuff, J.D. Vance had a comment, sort of channeling Bill the Butcher and the Know-Nothings. Have you seen this, Sean?
Oh, scary. That guy.
Yeah, what did he say? What did he say?
Well, he was trying, I think what he was trying to do was to make his case that when he's talking about immigration, he's not being a racist. Because if you look at... Okay. The immigration of the 19th century, these were white ethnic groups. And then if you watch Gang of New York, you can see the way that unassimilated large numbers of immigrants contribute to urban chaos and crime.
Sir, Senator Vance, Chris Cameron of the New York Times, you were talking about the relationship between crime and immigration, and my question is on that issue.
Please.
In an interview when you were running for Senate in September 2021, you were speaking with Jack Murphy, and you were talking about previous waves of immigration to the United States. You said the following. You had this massive wave of primarily Italian, Irish, and German immigration, and that had its problems, and that had its consequences. You pointed to these problems as being higher crime rates, ethnic enclaves, and inter-ethnic conflict. Should the United States have prescribed similar policies to what you're proposing now, including mass deportation, to deal with those issues?
Well, first of all, I also said there were a lot of benefits to that wave of immigration, but has anybody ever seen the movie Gangs of New York? That's what I'm talking about. We know that when you have these massive ethnic enclaves forming in our country, it can sometimes lead to higher crime rates.
So he's talking about the Irish before they became white.
Like, right. Yeah. Back to hard cracker shit.
And then, yeah, jumping forward a few decades to, you know, like the Al Smith type moment, like the pre-New Deal Democratic Party. There was, yeah, like you said, the urban machines versus the more, you know, WASPy bourgeoisie. Mm. And I think that's still, in a way, what this election sort of is. It's like the cities which heavily vote Democratic or heavily multicultural are heavily progressive on queer issues, women's rights, things along those lines, and understand with a certainty that we don't want to go back to a know-nothing style administration, which, with the Supreme Court backing it, wants to entrench the white patriarchy as the minoritarian rulers of this country. And what will that mean for an autonomous labor movement? Maybe nothing, you know, because there's tremendous hurdles to that either way. But it certainly spells doom for a progressive bureaucratic labor movement. The NLRB might be on its way out either way, but it has a much better chance under a Democratic administration. So depending on how we feel about the power of the labor movement as it currently exists, absolutely the Democrats are the way to go. But, you know, your point from before totally stands. Like, do we want that labor movement if it's complicit in U.S. imperialism and its atrocious foreign policy? You know, the labor movement has made a lot of very good stances supporting Palestine and ending the genocide. But, you know, what's the sincerity of that? It might be the same as whatever Kamala has to say during her speech. You know, it's, I think the base supports it. The Democratic Party base supports it. Like, certainly Hassan was getting lots of hugs and selfies in the hallways, and, you know, he was invited in to be a creator for Kamala. So there is a lot of sympathy for the ceasefire position, the pro-Palestinian position, but the party as it exists is not interested. So that there are contradictions within the Democratic Party that usually do not play out in a good way, but I think if the Republicans take power, they're increasingly less interested in a fair dual party bourgeois liberal stability. I think they're increasingly veering towards something like a minoritarian dictatorship in which the Democrats are shut out as a permanent opposition. And we're already seeing this with the way the Supreme Court works.
What do you think, Jana?
Yeah, I agree. I think I'm sympathetic to both takes. I think there's for sure like a lot to consider under both like a Trump and a Kamala, and what it means for the left. And I would say what it means for getting together a left, right? Because we are still in recomposition. I feel like perpetually in recomposition. Yeah. So it's like, what would make us stronger? What would make people feel like they have more power, right? There's a sense of like, you're not trying to fight for every little remaining civil right. And I think there's a lot of fear, and rightfully so, for what Trump would mean for the most marginalized folks in our world, right? What it would mean in the ways in which he's kind of chipped away at like the workings of the federal government, right? Which a lot of people fear would a Trump presidency would make it easier for him to push through a lot of things. But I also think a lot about, American capitalism, global capitalism, and, you know, which that's also what we're fighting against. So I'm not, you know, sometimes I think about like what that would mean in terms of a Trump versus a Kamala. I think Trump last time, I mean, just like the Democrats, he padded his cabinet with a lot of multimillionaires and billionaires, right? And gazillionaires. So, but of course, a lot to consider, like geopolitics, wars. I just think that I'm just a little bit weary about, what happened after Obama. I remember it was like this almost like exuberant, and in the recent DNC, there was an attempt to bring back that hope, that joy, right?
Right.
Michelle, I think, went up there and said something to the effect like, "Isn't this great?" Right, like to bring back kind of that Obama moment of like joy and hope. And I'd like to think that people are a little bit disengaged. I don't know if they feel as hopeful as they did watching like Gaza unfold, climate change, all these things. So I hope people push, but I'm afraid of what this renewed commitment by the Democrats would mean in essentially pulling left energy into the party base, right? Yeah. So kind of giving like these virtual signaling and saying, oh, you know, it's so unfortunate what's happening in Gaza, as if like a tornado hit and not like, no, Israel is trying to wipe it off the face of the earth.
Right. And so we're sending them 2,000-pound bombs and missiles.
Yeah.
And
or like, we're going to let this content creator come take selfies, you know, or whatever. So I just, I just wonder, like, what that means for our movements when we have the Democrats being so willing, allegedly, to listen to the left to the point where they are, you know, saying, hey, look, we elected this vice president who, you know, look, he was giving hygiene products to all the public schools. Like, this is so great, you know? And it's like, we should be weary. I mean, we know that there is a part of global capitalism that, well, we are, that global capitalism is in a crisis, right? And yep. There is a reformist wing to some degree. And I think Biden, Kamala, they represent to some degree that almost reformism of like trying to save the system from itself. Right. Right? So I don't know, I get a little concerned about the difficulty in the left being able to remain a distinct pole from all of this, right? From the Trumpers, from the liberals. And I feel like it's getting exceedingly difficult to do that a little bit.
It is. And I think that is like our overriding prime directive, not to sound like something from Star Trek, but like, you know, maintaining or building the left as like a separate pole, an independent pole, is absolutely essential. Like you mentioned something which is true and I think affects all of us and how we feel about politics in the world, which is, you know, the most marginalized people in our society suffering from very real policy differences between these two different parties. The question we should ask ourselves as the left, or maybe like the initial question that we ask ourselves when we say that we want the left to be independent from all this, is what's the relationship between the plight of oppressed and exploited people on the one hand and the state on the other? Because like, what is it that we truly believe on the left is the guarantor of like the rights and the life chances of marginalized people in our society? Do we believe, as the Democrats and to an extent the Republicans do, the Popular Front does, that it is the state that does that, right? That ultimately, like, society is so bad, society is so terrible, society is so scary. Any moment now, you know, we're going to end up back in the 1950s or we're going to end up back in the 1850s or whatever. Is society that scary? Like, are we willing to put our eggs in the basket of society instead of always and everywhere, always defending at the last minute, the state against society, right? The state as this grand arbitrator, you know, this neutral arbiter over what happens in the rest of society. And I say, and I think more and more people are saying too, that the plight of the marginalized is within the remit, not of the capitalist state, but within the working class as a whole. That it's we who need to start taking responsibility over ensuring that the life chances and the possibilities and the rights of those people, instead of always relying on the dying and decaying rights that are being taken away more and more with a very conservative judiciary, you know, of the capitalist state. I feel like we need a sea change. If we're going to have an independent left, it has to break with this Popular Front mentality that the marginalized people in our society, the most oppressive people in our society, need a capitalist state in order to ensure that they're okay. No, what they need is a working class movement composed of them and other leader and other members of the class that they are a part of to rise up and start taking our powers and our responsibilities that we already have that are implicit, that are latent right now in society, start taking them seriously. When the Republicans come in and they start slashing social programs, they start slashing civil rights, like, are we going to stop defending the rights of the oppressed and the exploited? No, we're going to have to double down. We're going to have to redouble those efforts, and we're going to have to build a class movement capable of synthesizing the entire interests of the class, the divergent and conflicting interests of the class. But we can only do that once more if we break with this Popular Front mentality that it's the bourgeois state that like gifts these rights onto people, gifts, you know, these social rights onto people, as opposed to like them being a product of us ourselves as a potentially powerful group within society that might overcome class society. I'm off my soapbox now.
Here. I just wanted to add two things. First is all of what Sean said didn't make it to the DNC, right? And I think like everybody on Twitter was like, there were so many tweets about like, where is the policy? Like, what are you going to do? Like, you know, and it's like, of course, maybe these conventions are not a place for policy. I mean, all I saw was USA, USA, Chants of USA, taking digs at Trump. You know, there was really nothing about what is going to be done. I mean, we are still living in a political moment where we're continuing to talk about the middle class. So even the Bernie, like working class, like those terms, like they're completely out.
Yep.
You know, so I think like we saw very little policy, and what policy we saw was very like law and order-ish, right? And then the last thing I'll say is I've been thinking a lot about this in terms of like the Democrats, and you know, and I think the boogeyman of Trump, and you know, of course, there's real fears not just with Trump, but like that whole ilk, right? And that MAGA vision, right, which is like a terrifying, fucked up vision. But, you know, I think what I try to remind myself is that, like, we're constantly, I feel like, in the shadow of, like, that 60s, like, late 60s moment, right?
Yes.
I mean, you know, it's like, I think starting with, like, Jimmy Carter, this is kind of, like, what I've been thinking about. It's like, the Democrats, starting with Jimmy, started to be a centrist party, right? And from that moment onwards, they've just constantly played to the Republicans, right? Like they don't have like, you know, so I think it's like, that's something that's like continuous. Like it's always whatever the Republicans are going to do, they're going to try to do it as well, right? It's like there's, and I think, you know, we're worried about the Republicans taking away social services. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember growing up in the 90s, it was Bill Clinton that ended welfare.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, so, you know, so yes. I think we need to like really remember too that the Democrats have been quite terrible as well at doing nothing to codify Roe v. Wade when they freaking knew. You mean to tell me you didn't know for 40 fucking years that the Republicans are trying to take this away? So come on, man. You know, and I think this is what I mean. I think a lot of people are just like kind of fed up. And my take is that there's a lot of excitement around Kamala being the first Black female president. You know, And I think, you know, justified in all of that. I think Chicago, right, the fact that the Obamas are like, you know, are still a pretty big deal in Chicago to some.
Oh, yeah.
Right? But I think a lot of other folks are just like, they're just ready for the clown show to be over, right? They're just like, I'm done. A lot of folks are just not engaged politically in that way. So my hope is with them. The disengaged.
Yeah. It always is, right? Our hope is always with like the broad masses who are disengaged. And I'm not even saying that people shouldn't vote for the Democrats, like as like a triage type situation. I just think that like you can spend the hour or two that it takes, or depending on what state you're in, to do that shit. But like our overriding drive, our prime directive should be to try to build a movement that has some hope and optimism that like we as the working class can salvage a society worth living in, and that ultimately tying ourselves to the state project is the number one detriment to that right now. And I think that that kind of movement is possible to see in our lifetimes, but we need to start seriously changing the way we think about our relationship to the capitalist state and to capitalist parties, and our relationship that we have within the class itself towards our brothers and sisters and siblings in the class. I don't know. I think the delegitimization of the Democrats and the Republicans, I think the dropping out of the vast majority of people from giving a shit about this is like very bad if you're, you know, you have something invested in this. But me, you know, I think it's a great potential for us to actually do something with this energy, even the negative aspect of that energy, and start to build things that can actually affect people's lives. Stuff like the Independent Labor Club of North America. Just a little, little plug for our group there.
Maybe I just have a sort of a last word on this before we close it up. I think, you know, we're talking about a few different categories here. We're talking about the state and the parties. We're talking about the left, and then we're talking about the working class and the people who are disengaged. You know, the left are people who are very interested in the in politics. Like, that's why we're talking about it right now. But the disengaged people, and this represents, I don't know what the voter rates are right now. Maybe half the country, in some places over half the country, do not vote. And the vast majority of the lower rungs of the working class and underclass people don't vote. The people who vote are, you know, tend to be older and wealthier. So in some ways we're already there where we don't have to say like a shift in mentality needs to be made because people already hate the parties and don't give a shit about the elections to the extent that they won't even vote. So the question is really, is the left orienting towards the elections, the parties by say like protesting the DNC, trying to get the Democrats to have better positions on things or non-genocidal positions on things, or are we orienting towards the people who don't care and don't vote and, you know, also don't really care about the left because they just see the left as the left wing of the Democrats. So, and that's really a question for us, like for you and me, Sean, like, should we, you know, if you had your way, would we just like, in 2020, we didn't talk about Trump at all. We like talked about Biden a little bit, but should we just, should this be our last election episode? No more.
No, I don't think that at all. In fact, I think that what Jana said and you said in the very beginning is very much true, that like the relationship between the left and the Democratic Party, the sort of rhetoric that comes out of you know, these conventions, this stuff is important to know about. And I'm actually remiss in like not paying all that much attention to it. It's just that I don't have a lot of time and I don't find it particularly you know, useful for myself at this moment in time. But we should be, you know, learning from this stuff, learning what works, learning what doesn't work. And I think we should remain engaged. And hell, I even say we should have like not an election night stream or whatever. Let's not get like, you know, let's not go fucking crazy here. But, you know, we should continue to do a little bit of election coverage. And I can't think of anybody better to do that with than our Chicago DNC correspondent, Jana. So I'm proposing sometime before the terrible election happens that we come back and we talk about this stuff again.
I just want to say that lastly, I think for a lot of people, myself included, elections are just like a form of entertainment.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, just even kind of on that baseline, right? Like most people, like, I don't know, anecdotally that I speak to, they're like, oh yeah, like can't wait for Trump versus Kamala, you know, because it's like, there is like something really entertaining about that.
There is. They make it entertaining.
I love it when she's like Donald and she like waves, you know, she kind of like does this like, you know, she like looks at him intensely and she's like, Donald, you know, I love that she refers to him by his first name. So I'm just like looking forward to the spectacle of it all, you know? And I think we got a little bit of taste of that at the DNC, but it was a very polished taste.
It was, right? It was
like, you know, very like, this is, we are the best party, right? We are, you know, we are the hope, we are the future. As you know, the DNC delegates, I don't know if you guys, the last image I want to leave you with, like when they were leaving the convention, protesters were like yelling at them and the delegates were like closing their ears. Like they were
ears. Yeah, I saw that.
And I was like, or like the poor 30 uncommitted delegates, you know, who were like trying to come into the convention area. So I don't know. I don't think the issue of Gaza is going to go away. You know, I think so many other issues are going to come up. So I don't know. I think it's going to be a really interesting, you know, time, even though it does seem sort of like, you know, a lot of that energy has sort of settled down with the DNC looking more united and actually, I don't know, having a strategy by picking literally the opposite of J.D. Vance. The last thing I'll say, like, I just thought it was like, he's pretty hilarious. He's like very folksy. And he was like, he's like, oh, yeah, he's like Hillbilly Elegy. Yeah, all the guys I knew growing up went to Yale, you know? And I was like, man, he's so sharp, you know? What? Oh, these charming devils of Democrats.
I know. God damn them. Well, you know, like you said, it's like a stage managed affair, and we're meant to feel that way at the end of it. These are competent people. That society can only progress and get better. We can only have multiculturalism. We can only have, like, working class bureaucratic institutions like trade unions if we vote for these people. And that's the whole fucking deal. And the point is you don't even have to fall for that shit if you don't want to.
Yeah, I'm like, you know, obviously I talk a lot about sports. I'm writing a book about baseball, and I see so many similarities. And like, we went to Sean and I went to a Mets game last week, and we were talking about this ridiculous idea that like the left chose Tim Walz, and so now DSA is part of the coalition. And it just reminded me of like someone who tweets at Steve Cohen on Twitter, like you got to trade, you got to DFA this guy, and then it happens, and they feel like they did it. Right. There's like the spectacle of participation. But on the other hand, Jana, have you ever read C.L.R. James's American Civilization?
Yeah.
There's a great essay in there about the democratic aspects of entertainment and how entertainment. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a one idea of it that is just like brainwashing us with ideology, but that's not really how it works. Like, they have to show us things that we want to see that's going to get us engaged. And this is how elections work. There is actually as absurd and untruthful as our democracy is, there is an aspect of it that needs to channel people's voice in some way.
Yeah.
Most people don't give a shit, though, so it's not quite working.
Well, my dinner's here. Jana, this has been great. Thank you so much. Yeah. I'm going to go work a bunch more overtime, but I'm going to be off soon. We'll have more great content coming out. I can leave you guys to it if you want to continue talking, maybe do a bonus or something like that. Up to you guys.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.